now as well. So welcome to this session of the Futures Foundation Futures Forum. I'll introduce our guest in a moment, but first allow me to outline what will happen. Those of us physically present, thanks to the good graces of Steve Shepherd from Randstad, will listen to our guest for about 45 minutes, and this will be audio recorded. After he finishes, we'll turn off the recorder and have a conversation amongst ourselves. I hope that those of you listening to a podcast will also take an opportunity to talk about the ideas presented today, because that's what these forums are all about, actively creating a better Australia. Our guest today is Robin Williams, best known to many Australians as the presenter of The Science Show, which began in 1975, and various other programs on the ABC. Robin was born and educated in England, and along with his science degree, also gained some acting experience, appearing in such shows as The Goodies and Doctor Who, among others. In Australia, he was deputy chair of Australia's Commission for the Future, and in 1998 was voted as one of Australia's living treasures. He's also an author of a number of factual books and a novel. Robin's theme for this evening is the role of science in creating Australia's future. Please join me in welcoming Robin Williams.
Thanks very much indeed. My first involvement with science programmes was 1972, when I was required to produce a programme called Innovations. And it was an interesting exercise because the programme was presented by a freelance person called Glenn Menzies. I often wonder what happened to Glenn Menzies. If anyone knows, let me know. And one of the exciting things for the programme was when some boxes arrived from the British High Commission promoting their various products. And I was told that this was the way in which we looked to the future as to what new designs and new gadgets were there available. And I asked rather innocently, don't we have any? Oh, there are some occasionally. We go to universities and we phone up the engineers and they tell us what they're hoping to do. And it was kind of a bit blundery like that. And I was rather puzzled until I met somebody actually in Melbourne who was a senior person in the CSIRO with whom I once played royal tennis here, which was quite exciting. And he told me the story of the way in which, during the Second World War, the links to the Empire, the Commonwealth, and certainly to Europe were cut off. And suddenly, in a blink, Australia made its own stuff. Its instruments, its cameras, amazingly quickly. If you want to know the story, in fact, I did a three-part series called Innovations, actually, in the Science Show last year, presented by Mark Dodgson, who's a professor in business studies at the University of Queensland. And he goes back to the early stages when Europeans came to this country and the kinds of problems that they tried to solve. And they were, of course, cut off from everybody, and so they had to be ingenious. And then the innovation during the 20th century showed how an awful lot of bright ideas were neglected. In fact, I have a friend who's written a book about the myths of Australian inventions, and it's quite salutary. The list that you have, the stump job plough and the xerography and various things like that, they're partially true, but they don't amount to that much. But when you ask the universal question, which I love to put, what did Henry Sutton do in Ballarat in 1885? Nobody knows the answer. Not. He invented television. And he carried pictures of the Melbourne Cup from here to Ballarat so that they could see the race.
Wow.
He also invented any number of other things. In fact, he entertained Alexander Graham Bell. And they looked at this wonderful contraption called the telephone. And Henry Sutton said, "Do you know, you've got this box on the wall and you've got this cup that you put your ear. Why don't you have them both in one? And it's now called the handset." And it has astonished me. I was saying this to Catherine Livingstone the other day, just to drop another name, the head of Telstra. And she nodded very vigorously because she was one of the only people in the room that actually knew the story of Henry Sutton. And then I became rather sceptical as I began to broadcast about what innovation was made of, who invented what innovation means rather than invention, and how the credit for various breakthroughs weren't quite what they seemed. We know about penicillin, and we know that Alexander Fleming was something of a fraud because, okay, he spotted penicillin growing in a dish, wrote it up briefly, and then forgot all about it. And a few years later, much to his amazement, got a Nobel Prize. Mm. Whereas the brilliant team who did the innovation in, what was it, 4 years using bedpans, led by the great Australian Howard Florey. Okay, so here's another question that's possibly on the same level as what Henry Sutton did in 1885, but it's not directly to do with this country, except that Florey was a great example of how someone led a brilliant team and got acknowledged, but another bloke took some of the kudos. The question is, what did Albert Schatz do in 1943, and why don't you know anything about it? Well, if you think that discovering the effects of penicillin is really amongst the greatest achievements ever, what about finding a cure for TB? In a book called Experiment Number 11, Peter Pringle, who writes for the New York Times and writes for the Sunday Times of London, and actually wrote a book with our own chairman of the ABC, Jim Spiegelman, called Nuclear Barons. Peter Pringle wrote the story of how after 10 experiments, taking dirt, soil, and putting it next to the TB germ, suddenly Schatz noticed there was an effect. And he found a cure for tuberculosis, which had been a scourge of mankind forever. And the next thing that happened, of course, they did the tests not in the dish but on people, and it worked. And his professor Waxman nicked the kudos and got the Nobel Prize. The story is astounding. Now, these things change the course of history. Television changes the course of history, as does a cure for all those diseases that penicillin dealt with, not least syphilis, infections, and tuberculosis, the discovery of Albert Schatz, who eventually, by the way, got a glorified PhD from Rutgers University when they were shamed into realising their mistake. And then I discovered that an awful lot of Australians had indeed changed the course of history without being properly acknowledged. Most famously, Lawrence Bragg, who 100 years ago developed Bragg's law to work out how you can tell the shape of crystals through X-rays. And of course, that's the basis of molecular biology and most of the pharmaceutical industry producing drugs and who knows what else. DNA, need I say more? So there you've got the influences. That's why I find science so incredibly exciting, and why I continue after 42 years since that first program, Innovations, to run around campuses finding out what people are actually doing. But if you look at the rate of change, people have got a kind of approximate understanding of how much change actually takes place. You think with all these new devices, you know, this is the latest smartphone, it's much better than the one you have because it cannot be in any way hacked and never requires a new battery. It's called the iPair 7. I'll show you what it does in a minute. But when I started the Science Show in 1975, as you said, Charles, there were no laptops, there were no mobile phones, there were no ATMs, holes in the wall from which you get money, no DVDs, no CDs, certainly no smartphones, And most people under 25 would not believe what I just said. They can't imagine a world that hasn't got those things in it. I regard many of those very useful inventions and devices, but I think an awful lot of what they do is just mere decoration. Okay, you find out gossip maybe an hour faster. Does that make much difference? Because when I ask people what's just happened in the world, they look blank. You know, it seems journalists are terribly keen on getting information maybe half an hour earlier. But is anyone else? Does it actually matter? But if you go even further back to when I was born and becoming conscious, let's say 1945, living in West London, my family had never owned a car in the whole of its history. Our household had no phone. We had no television. We had certainly no computers, because we didn't know anything about computers. And we had no toilet paper, because we had strips of the daily whatever it was pinned up in the toilet. And we also had no fruit, because when I was shown a banana when I was about 5 or 6, I had no idea what it was. Now, we didn't particularly think of ourselves as being monumentally deprived, but I always think of those images as being gigantically different from the way we live now. No car, no phone, no telly in the whole of my family's history. So you can actually track the way the world changes, and the question is whether you can do anything about it in terms of the future to see where we're going and how. And it's for that reason that Barry Jones asked myself, Philip Adams and a few others to join his Commission for the Future in the mid-80s. And we were very thoughtful about that, and we said, well, it's not a futurology outfit. We don't actually sit there and say the world is going to have, like Asimov did at one stage, a population like this or transport like that or whatever. But what we did instead is say, what would you like your future to be like? Have some kind of brain adventure and do it in a rather more simple way. Just picture your own neighborhood. What would your workplace be like? What would your school be like? What would your house be like? What would you need from it? And then the idea was we could create a public debate and ask Australia what they thought in various places about how their place should actually change and under what circumstances. This was a mixed success. We had a number of speakers. We had some guy from Canada called Suzuki come out, who since has become rather famous in this country, probably as much as in Canada. He was generally going to what some people call the alarmist mode of thinking, that most things were going to be terrible. And the thing I found most difficult to take about what David Suzuki was saying is that he tended to denigrate the work of science. And for someone who was in fact a very good professor of genetics and had been trained fabulously as a scientist both in Canada and in Amherst in America, and whose wife taught scientific history at Harvard, I thought he was bringing the reputation of scientists down somewhat further than they deserved. And another thing we did at the Commission for the Future was have Greenhouse 88. Now, greenhouse gases, in other words, and 1988, a long time ago, we were trying to make sense of some of the news coming out of NASA and various other places about the climate change problems that have since become extremely famous and enable Australia to prepare for a debate about what to do. Other than that, the Commission for the Future went on for a little bit after the demise of the Hawke government, and I talked about something that then had happened right towards the end in my book, which I see is on your table, I'm very grateful, called Future Perfect. Because what happened when we ran out of money, the government no longer funded it, and we got a certain amount of funds from the National Australia Bank and here and there, and I was chairman for a while, and then John Button was chairman. Interesting that John Button of this parish was willing to be chairman of the Commission for the Future when he'd been somewhat sceptical about the whole enterprise and argued with Barry Jones about whether it was a good idea. But John was very, very keen in the end, and he decided he would have a conference at Macquarie University involving 100 of the smartest young people in Australia. And just to give you a kind of feeling for the date, it was just after the massacre in Tasmania, when 37 people were slaughtered. And as a result of that, John Howard, the Prime Minister, did what I thought was one of the bravest and most significant things. He put a substantial limit on gun ownership in this country, quite quickly. And when the young people turned up at Macquarie University for our conference, the 100 smartest young people we could find, many of them came from the country and were arguing with their townie friends about why you needed guns, because the country kids knew that they had a good reason, and the townies said it was out of the question, bad idea. At least there was a discussion, but it shows you it was in the, 97, I think it might have been, 1997, a bit. It wouldn't have been in 96, because when the change of government happened, I think that left only a few months of 96, so about 1997. And on the first day, it was 4 days, we had John Howard turn up, we had Peter Garrett turn up, we had a number of people of a certain status, and on the first day, the kids just mucked up. They thought, this is a tremendous laugh, we're in the big city, let's just have fun. On the second day, they recovered from having fun and blinked and looked around. And on the third day, they saw that they had people like the Prime Minister and some substantial Australians talking to them and also listening to them. And on the third day, there was a gigantic change. And on the fourth day, they told us that they'd never imagined that people would take what they said seriously, especially considering their future. And in my book, I registered some of the letters we had afterwards saying it was one of those moving experiences of their lives. And could we please do it again? Of course, that's the last thing the Commission for the Future ever did, which is rather sad. But it shows you, if you get kids together and listen to them, it changes how they view their life and their community, really.
I'm going to break the rules and interrupt for a brief moment, just to let you know that probably you don't know that the archives for the Commission for the Future were gifted to the Futures Foundation and then went on to the University of Technology in Sydney. So that's where they are now. So they actually came through this organisation on their
own. I'm delighted. So you've probably seen them and you probably can bear out what I said about that, which I find quite extraordinary. So that leaves you in a situation where you're trying actually to make sense these days of where we go. So I'll talk about the literature and I'll talk about my device. The literature, I happen to have in my hand the New Statesman. I've also got Spectator. We have a balanced intake. The New Statesman is pretty centre-of-the-road publication with some very substantial editors. One stage last year, one of the editors was the Archbishop of Canterbury. And, mind you, another one was Russell Brand, but its cover story, date 4th to the 10th of April, that's last Friday, The Tech Utopia, where we sold a lie about the digital future. And if you go in, there's a substantial article, many pages, by Brian Appleyard, who's a famous author writing about science and other matters, mainly for the Sunday Times. And it says, Hot Gospelers in Hoodies, Why Futurologists Are Always Wrong and why we should be sceptical of techno-utopians. Well, he's being rude mainly about people like Ray Kurzweil, who, of course, has some rather extraordinary ideas about the future, which Brian Appleyard calls semi-religious. And his main aim is to convince us that nobody really can be sure of what the future holds. And when you've got people who are vaguely utopian about the future, be suspicious of them, because what they're trying to do really is to sell a bag of something. Now, it's quite different from what we were talking about, the Commission for the Future, and that is imagining in a simple way how you might picture your, well, let's say a school. Okay, your school is a place where you have teachers and pupils. Very simple and very old-fashioned. And the question is, do you really want a building, rather like a hospital as a place where you treat sick people? But now you regard that rather as industrial health care. It's very, very costly and seems unaffordable. And you've got machines which, I suppose, can make it decentralized. You can have health care in a way that you needn't have had it in the 20th century you probably did. You had to centralize services. But now you don't so much need to have them. Whereas a school, you want young people to be together, do you not? You don't want them in their isolation. And you want a broad range of teachers who can cover the curriculum. Now, you've also got new technology, so how will that change how young people work? Well, when I did a set of interviews on an experiment done in Western Australia on how the iPad has affected the classroom, it turned out that many young children learn faster using the iPad if they do it well. But the highly significant thing about it was that they were working together now as never before. So it did have an effect. It had a positive effect, but it still showed they needed to be in a place united. So if you do that kind of thought experiment as to what a school might be like, these are some of the considerations. Would you like a place that's local, that's a building, where relationships can be formed, where ideas can be discussed, where new technology can be used, and where the children can begin to have a kind of education that is not old-fashioned, because it's using new techniques, but being informed of change, but nonetheless remaining convinced that they are little human beings who need a social input, not simply a chunk of information hurled at them by electronics. So, that's an experiment that young people and parents can do. What sort of school would you like? I just so happen to have with me a contrasting publication to the New Statesman I simply looked at just now, and one which is positive about looking to the future and which reflects some of the ideas that came out of the Commission for the Future, and it's called The World We Made, Alex Mackay's Story from 2050, and it's written by a friend of mine called Jonathan Porritt. Anyone heard of Jonathan Porritt? The name Porritt, ring a bell? No.
No.
Not having much luck tonight, am I? Anyone see the film Chariots of Fire?
Yes.
Well, Porritt's father came third in the race. And he went on to become Governor General of New Zealand, and then Lord Porritt, Surgeon Sergeant to the Queen. And Jonathan Porritt, you could actually call Sir Jonathan if you wanted to, but he doesn't actually use that term. He advises Prince Charles on various matters to do with the environment, and he's a totally wonderful person. And he heads an outfit called Forum for the Future, and the magazine that they publish is called Green Futures, in which they've canvassed lots of individual things, like will there be planes flying in 2050 despite problems with greenhouse? And so they look at the evidence. And he is writing a story involving somebody called Alex Mackay. The name Alex Mackay is purposely not male or female. It could be either. I don't know why I chose Mackay, but short. And each of the little chapters, which are only about 4 pages long, looks at a whole number of things about how the world was made. Water, fisheries, restoring the web of life, the law, the Houston Concord on climate change in 2050, the Great Turning, whatever that means, taming our capital markets, nuclear power's last gasp, he's not terribly keen on the nuclear option, the energy internet, the wonders of modern medicine, malaria defeated, miracle cures, democracy by demand, urban make, you've got the idea. And so what he's doing is showing how you perhaps imagine the future based on current trends, and then how you reverse engineer how you get there. But it's an exercise for the people on how you can imagine what the future may be like, doing exactly what you're doing. And I found it very interesting when you looked at aircraft, for example, because, well, in one of the broadcasts we made, Geraldine Duke in Saturday Extra phoned me up one day and said, we talked about travel and how you can get to all sorts of places around the world. And we're just doing a section, she said, on tourism. And someone wrote in saying, how dare you talk about tourism as if it's an automatic thing. No responsible person flies in planes anymore. So she said, what do you think, Robin? And I said, well, there have actually been dramatic changes in aircraft, and there are huge plans, but of course it takes something like 20 years to get an aircraft up from its basic design. There is something called the silent aircraft being worked on in Cambridge, which will use less than half the fuel of equivalent planes today, and they're already, the planes that are flying today, much more quiet and fuel efficient than they were quite a short time ago. And if you look at the trends in terms of greenhouse, well, the internet uses twice as much of the energy requirement and produces twice the number of greenhouse gases as does the aircraft industry. But nobody seems to be complaining about the internet. And more recently, I refer you to Morwell, which is where that coal, that hole in the ground, has been burning for, what is it now, 5 weeks, 6 weeks? Some of them have been burning since 1962. It turns out that holes in the ground on fire produce 3% of greenhouse gases, the same as the aircraft industry. Why doesn't someone go around? Surely, if you've gone to the moon, you can put out holes in the ground which are on fire. It's just nobody wants to finance such a thing, because where's the profit? Where's the incentive? They just let them burn. On and on it goes. So here are some choices that can be made. Here are policies, and here are equivalents. You look about this versus that. That is something for an ascent for democracy, an informed democracy. And the next thing you ask yourself is, would people who are informed make better decisions? Now, I happened to run something in Occam's Razor on that 3 weeks ago. Craig Cormick. And he was trying to work out what the Australian population thinks of science, and therefore how much they are considering information and evidence before they make decisions. And it turns out that a good 30 or 35% of the population is not interested in scientific information when they're making up their minds. They have a set of values, and the values come first, and science comes way down the track. So if you want to influence these people and persuade them to do something that seems to go against their values, you've got to use a different approach. You don't use a global scientific approach, or even one that says here is the general future of the nation. Instead, you talk to them as farmers, as fishers, as people who have to shop, or shop cheaply, people who've got particular beliefs which may be religious, and once you've talked to them in those terms, you then work out what it is that, say, a farmer would do in his or her own interests and approach it that way. Interestingly enough, it's 25 years since Landcare was set up, led by a former Premier of Victoria. And she and others were trying to say, look, we can't just do what we like with the land, and you know it because you're farmers and you experiment with nature every year. And so if you connect the farmers and the environmentalists and the scientists and have a useful conversation, you will do rather better. And that worked. It turns out that the farmers are some of the most sensitive people when it comes to applying scientific knowledge and planning for the future. You can now, in Tasmania, and to some extent on the mainland, it's getting better and better, get 10 by 10 square kilometre sections of the landscape and get predictions from informed science of what the rainfall is going to be like, the drought's going to be like, the temperatures are going to be like, even the wind patterns, because they're important, so that you can plan what you do next. Now that is affecting people who've got values connected to the land. And those are the ways, it seems to me, to work forward, to make a difference when it comes to persuading people about how they select their own future based on science. Another way, which is wonderfully dependent on the new technology, and I'm coming to my machine, is something called citizen science. Now that started quite some time ago. Environmental people did, like Lord Krebs. I talked to Lord Krebs here 3 weeks ago, and he is at Jesus College in Oxford. We call him Lord Jesus as a result. But if you know anything about science, his father is the man behind the Krebs cycle, and he got the Nobel Prize for it, and one of the people I interviewed in 1972. Amazing encounter with someone whose work I had reproduced in umpteen examinations. And Krebs, Lord Krebs, John Krebs, told me that they'd been using it, for instance, in birds on the landscape, because he's an ornithologist. He specialises in the way that farming in Britain affects the birds and the hedgerows and so on. And so who better to ask than some of the farmers, some of the bird enthusiasts, and they've been doing it that way. In Oxford again, they've got something called Galaxy Zoo, where they have, in one experiment, a vast number of galaxies to sort into one or the other category. And the person who's doing the research, possibly for a PhD, I can't remember, worked out that at the rate he was going, sorting them would take him till he was 178. So they put the pictures on the internet and asked the public to sort them. Two things happened. One of them is the first, that the server melted because people were so keen. And the second thing, okay, the population did this all very well. They were adept, even if there were six, or even if there were 92. But they spotted things the scientists had missed, because the scientists were looking for one thing, whereas the public said, hey, what's that over here? So it's been a wild success. And if you think about it, with a disconnection between science and the public, here is an opportunity in which we can have any number of different fields, and I can think of about 14 at the moment, in which you can have the public being asked to help scientists to do some information searches. One of the ones that was launched last week was by David Caroli from the University of Melbourne to work on climate change. There's another one here in Victoria to do with Earthwatch, where they have some environmental work to do. Another one in Tasmania is called Red Map, where fishers and others have got to take pictures of fish and birds and such like to see whether they've moved north or south. Which brings me to this device, which is, as I said, Charles, if I wanted to get in touch with you, this is the way I would do it. I'd open this and I'd take out this device and I'd write Charles here. And I'd say, why late? And then you would take this chalk and you'd write underneath, and it would say Qantas plane weather or something. Now there you are, you don't have to download it, it's there, and you can put it in your pocket, take it back into your office, and as I said, can't be hacked. It was given to me by somebody called Henry Hoke, who was actually a stand-up comic from Melbourne. Hoax phone, which is a pair, with wood on one side. And but the point about this is to illustrate something quite interesting, and that is going back finally to innovation. When you ask yourself who is doing the most innovating now, you think, even though he doesn't do much anymore, Steve Jobs. He is the entrepreneur. He takes devices and he makes them like this, and you can do all sorts of things. You can have all this information. You can have your email on it, even though you don't use it. And don't get my messages. Not sent like that for once. But if you ask yourself, this smartphone was based on 7 scientific technological breakthroughs, including GPS, touchscreen, you name it. All of them came from campus research laboratories. All of them were funded by government grants. Jobs put them together. He didn't invent anything. Smartphones came from science. And the thing is, if we want to make our future something that has got some options, I think we've got to realise where innovation and change comes from and how. There are all sorts of things I could talk about in terms of brilliant science that could be applied. One of my favourites from this parish, which I'll end on, is something dreamed up by Rachel Webster and her mate, who actually found some of the iron ore in the ranges in Western Australia by nicking, he was given some technology from the Pentagon, which enables you to kind of x-ray mountains. And what Rachel and he want to do is get the heat out from the Latrobe Valley, which is kept under the brown coal. You don't dig up the brown coal, you keep it as a blanket and squirt down CO2 and get back up water that's hot, which drives turbines, which apparently can provide half the energy needs of the state of Victoria for several hundred years. Why isn't this being done? Investment. Because digging up black coal and burning it is cheaper, which I found always, because going back to my home in 1945-44, my father was a coal miner from South Wales. That's what he did when he was 14. It strikes me as incredibly 19th century. You go down a pit, you dig up the coal, and then you burn it. It's almost funny. You know that sketch about tobacco? Okay, you roll it up, and you put it in your face, and you set it on fire, and then you try to breathe. Well, it seems to me there is the contrast. And, I think science is the essence of our future. We can't predict it, but we certainly can give ourselves the choices. So thank you.
Thank you.